Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents George Washington and the Irish. Incredible stories of the Irish spies, soldiers and workers who helped free America. By Niall O'Dowd. Narrated by John Keating. America was lost by Irish emigrants, I am assured from the best authority. The major part of the American army was composed of Irish, and that the Irish language was as commonly spoken in the American ranks as English. I am also informed it was their valour that determined the contest. Lord Mountjoy, British Parliament, April 2, 1784. Introduction. Freedom's Sons and Daughters. The Story of the Irish and George Washington. There is no doubt that Ireland's sons and daughters played a major role in the battle for American independence from the British Crown. As leading Revolutionary War historian Thomas Fleming has noted, the Irish responded en masse to the call for resistance to England. With more than 300,000 of them in the colonies, they had a major impact on the war. You would be hard-pressed to find an account of the full Irish commitment. Historians have mainly ignored or rarely referenced their role. This is an opportunity to set the record straight. As Philip Thomas Tucker, PhD, a prolific historian of the Revolutionary War, writes, "For more than two centuries, what has been most forgotten about America's stirring creation story were the crucial and disproportionate contributions that the Irish people played in the winning of the American Revolution." What this book shows is that the impact of the Irish was not confined to war. It was the loving care given by Irish nurses to wounded soldiers. It was the cooking, cleaning and laundry work done by Irish camp followers that kept an army marching. It was the fearless advocacy for freedom from successful immigrant politicians and business leaders. It was the secret intelligence and spy work that resulted in great victories and disasters avoided. And, yes, of course, there was the bravery of the men who fought at Bunker Hill, Princeton, Trenton, Yorktown, and all the great battle sites. There is the closeness of Washington to the Irish, rarely revealed. We will also see the social Washington, a beloved and frequent guest at the Friendly Sons of St. Patrick's dinners, or visiting with his favourite Irish bartender in a Delaware Irish pub. We will see him during formal occasions, dancing minuets and waltzes at the home of his great Irish friend, General Henry Knox, or wining and dining his Irish neighbours at Mount Vernon. Of course, there was the famous St. Patrick's Day celebration in 1780, after a winter of discontent at Valley Forge. But there is also the story of how the Irish and German soldiers almost came to blows as Washington tried to intervene. The following year, Washington used St. Patrick's Day as the only day off of the year to uplift his men after a cruel winter. It was an almost mystical bond between Washington and the Irish. The fierce commitment when they realized Washington was not anti-Irish Catholic, like so many, and was ready to die for his ideals, and the fact that he hated the common enemy, the British, as much as they did. Indeed, in one case, we find Washington marvelling at the ornate statuary at a Catholic mass he attended, and wondering why he wasn't more drawn to the religion. Battlefield generals and ordinary soldiers fought with rare fury for him. The obscure tailor Hercules Mulligan became a master spy, one so good that CIA chief William Casey once wondered if he wasn't the greatest American spy of all. Mary Travers, a beloved nurse, became an angel of the camps. Elizabeth Thompson became Washington's housekeeper at the age of 72, and he was devoted to her. There is also the story of men like Washington's chief aide, John Fitzgerald, whose riveting account of crossing the Delaware with Washington provided an incredible eyewitness account of perhaps the most important moment in America's history. George Washington and the Irish will show the bravery of the Irishmen, who knew they could be signing their death warrants when they printed and signed the Declaration of Independence. For many, it was revenge for what the British had done to them in their own country. We will also highlight the story of James Hoban, the unknown Irish architect who had a chance encounter with Washington and ended up designing the White House. This book, then, is the largely untold story of how the Irish played a decisive part in helping George Washington defeat the British in perhaps the most significant war in history. A war where democracy was first forged and the divine right of kings to rule was forever ended. It also dispels the myths that few Irish Catholics fought. There were 10,000 Irish names on the Continental Army muster rolls at the beginning of the war, and many more joined. There were also, of course, thousands of Scots-Irish Presbyterians, themselves forced to leave Ireland because of the draconian penal laws that forbid any religion but Anglican, also known as the Church of England. Among those who fought were the teenage son of Irish immigrants, Andrew Jackson, and Kate Barry, daughter of Irish immigrants, who became a legendary figure. We will relay the extraordinary experiences of ordinary people at the time, witnesses to history like the Irishman who took care of Benjamin Franklin in his later years, and who witnessed the final embrace between Washington and Franklin. We will also hear Franklin's prescient letter from Ireland. There is also the extraordinary tale of how the iconic Washington painting we are all so familiar with, the one used on the $1 bill, was first dreamt up by a prisoner in an Irish debtor's jail. We also have an Irish rogues gallery with this book, including the Irish Major General who was the leader in a plot to see Washington replaced and possibly eliminated after early losses. The first traitor in American history to be hanged was Irish as well. The scope of George Washington and the Irish covers the numerous generals and lieutenants from Ireland that Washington had under his command, and his complete familiarity with the Irish situation, which he likened to Americans trying to roust the British. He could hardly have been unaware of the importance of the Irish to him. According to Christopher Kline, writing on history.com, generals born in Ireland or who had Irish parents commanded 7 of the 11 brigades wintering in Morristown. So this book covers the Revolutionary War contributions of ordinary men and women who never wrote down their history and involvement in events. Many, indeed, were illiterate to begin with. Those who wrote the history hardly bothered with the immigrants anyway. They were viewed by most with a severely jaundiced eye. Many were indentured servants, essentially owned by their masters, until they paid them back for their passage to America. So the stories of how the Irish fought for, died for, bled for, and won massive naval battles for George Washington are generally untold, as is the story of the Cork soldier who first referred to the United States of America. The heroism of the Scots-Irish in the war is also revealed. There are also extraordinarily uplifting stories. When Washington was elected president, the Continental Congress sent an Irishman from Derry, Charles Thompson, the secretary of the Congress, in essence the speaker, to inform him. The fact that Thompson had arrived in America as a penniless orphan makes his story all the more remarkable. We will also deal with the issue of slavery and the Irish, and the sad realization that many Irish, despite their own background of oppression, were sadly lacking any insight into how dreadful slavery was, though there were many honourable exceptions. Charles Thompson, for instance, did more than free slaves. He hired black labour and allowed them to work their own shareholding lands, and provided decent accommodation for them. 12 American presidents owned slaves, which, alas, was the wretched context of the times. But many of the Irish seemed indifferent to the awful mistreatment of slaves. The military contribution has long been omitted, but that is changing. As historian Philip Thomas Tucker puts it, "So many Irish served in the ranks of the Pennsylvania Continental Line, the backbone of Washington's Continental Army, and one of its largest units, that this hard-fighting unit was correctly known as the Line of Ireland." We have the singular testimony of the famed Virginia cavalryman Light Horse Harry Lee, father of Robert E. Lee, who said the Irish line was "singularly fitted for close and stubborn action, hand-to-hand, in the centre of the army, and always preferred an appeal to the bayonet to a toilsome march." Another officer said of them, "They served everywhere and surrendered nowhere." Historian Michael O'Brien, after exhaustive research, reckoned 38% of Washington's army was Irish or Scots-Irish. O'Brien produced evidence from Revolutionary muster rolls that there were 695 Kellys in the American Army, 494 Murphys, 331 McCarthys, 327 Connors or O'Connors, 322 Ryans, and 248 Dochertys, and that was before other common names were counted. Yet the Irish have been shut out of Revolutionary War history, as it has been written by grandees who had no time for the immigrants and their spawn. Anti-Catholicism ran rampant, but there never was a harsh word on a person's religion from Washington, it must be noted. As historian Thomas Fleming notes, "Henry Cabot Lodge tried to claim that the revolutionaries in Massachusetts were of almost pure English blood, with a small infusion of Scotch-Irish from Londonderry. Actually, historian O'Brien found 3,000 unquestionably Irish names on the state's revolutionary muster rolls, and not one Lodge. So the numbers speak for themselves. The glorious chapter of the Irish in the fight for democracy has never been fully told. This book is not an exhaustive who's who of everyone who fought or led, or it would be as long as the Bible, but an overdue account of the importance of Aaron's sons and daughters in achieving that most vital of victories. It also highlights the rarely revealed unbreakable link between Washington and his Irish comrades, something, ironically, the British grasped, as Lord Mountjoy's quote that opened the book shows. On far foreign fields, the soldiers and chiefs of the Irish brigades fought and died, but their contribution was never greater than helping create the dawn of democracy. Born into oppression, they became freedom's sons and daughters. Prologue. A Fine Day for Freedom. On Evacuation Day in New York, November 25, 1783, before George Washington arrived to declare his country free, the last skirmish of the Revolutionary War that changed the world forever occurred. It involved a proud, newly minted American citizen, whose first name is lost to history, the wife of Irish-American Benjamin Day, and an outraged British officer on Murray Street, now part of the district known as Tribeca, in Manhattan. Mrs. Day kept a boarding house and was well known as a stout patriot who never concealed her opinions, according to Dr. Andrew Anderson, a witness to subsequent events, as reported in the book Hours with the Living Men and Women of the Revolution, by oral historian Benson John Lossing. The British had claimed the right of possession of New York City until noon on evacuation day, but Mrs. Day was having none of it. Soon after breakfast that day, she proudly went outside and displayed the Stars and Stripes flag for all to see on a nearby pole. Around 9 a.m. that same morning, Dr. Anderson, lounging idly on the porch outside his home, observed a burly, red-faced British officer in full uniform walking rapidly in the direction of the flag. Mrs. Day was quietly sweeping the street outside her door when the officer came upon her and screamed, "Who hoisted that rebel flag?" Mrs. Day stopped sweeping and stated, "It is not a rebel flag, sir, but the flag of a free people." "Pull down that flag," roared the officer. "Who are you?" Mrs. Day asked. "I'm His Majesty's Provost Marshal, charged not to let a rebel flag fly in this town before noon today. Pull down that flag." "I will not do it," Mrs. Day replied. "If the King himself stood where you did and commanded me to pull it down, I wouldn't do it." Several cries of approval and huzzas could be heard from nearby neighbours' homes. "You cursed rebels in petticoats," exclaimed the officer. "If you were not a woman, I'd hang you on the spot. That rebel flag shall come down." He seized the halyards. Mrs. Day sprang forward and, with her broom, struck the intruder with heavy and rapid blows. The burly Briton was knocked down. Eventually he stood up and snatched his hat from the ground, muttering curses and slinking off, never to return. The first free American flag ever flown in New York fluttered quietly in the gentle breeze. The British were gone after more than 160 years of dominance in America. The world was upside down. Chapter 1. Hercules Mulligan. Thinker, tailor, sleeper, spy. On the morning after Evacuation Day, November 25, 1783, George Washington, newly resident in New York, kept a breakfast engagement. He was the hero of the hour, fêted the night before at France's Tavern by Governor Clinton of New York and many other leading figures. He was the magnificent leader of a brand new nation that, even then, looked likely someday to be the most powerful on earth. He had just held a farewell morning parade in Bowling Green. The British ships had sailed for home after 7 years of occupying New York, their grasp on world domination shattered for all time. Their ignominious defeat at the Battle of Yorktown in 1781 dealt a fatal blow to their empire building and willingness to fight. Even the mad King George III knew the jig was up. The cost of supplying an army in America, a crushing burden, at a time when the British economy was in dire straits. It was time to wind down. America would be free. From Yorktown on, the outcome of the fight was inevitable, and the capture of New York by the rebels on that famed, clear and crisp November day, 2 years later, was merely the coda to a magnificent American campaign. The British drummers and fife had allegedly played a tune called "The World Turned Upside Down" after the Yorktown defeat. Indeed it was. The signing of the Treaty of Paris ended hostilities between the United States and Great Britain on September 3, 1783. But such was the panicked mass seeking to get out that it took until November for the British and many of their loyalist American supporters to evacuate. Suddenly, Washington had become a worldwide legend. The indomitable general who whipped an army of peasants, farmers, militia members, and poor city dwellers into such fighting trim that they had defeated what was considered the most powerful army on earth. Washington had help from the French, but his leadership was unquestioned. On Tuesday, November 25, 1783, known as Evacuation Day ever since, with the British ships beyond the horizon, Washington would lead his men in a victory parade on Broadway. The contrast between the departing British army, all spit and polish and serried files, and the ragtag army of Washington was so remarkable that a young female onlooker wrote, per the New York Times, "The troops just leaving us were as if equipped for show, and with their scarlet uniforms and burnished arms, made a brilliant display. The troops that marched in, on the contrary, were ill-clad and weather-beaten, and made a forlorn appearance. But then they were our troops, and as I looked at them, and thought upon all they had done for us, my heart and eyes were full, and I admired and gloried in them more because they were weather-beaten and forlorn." Each soldier wore a black and white cockade in honour of the French who had played such a role in their victory. They marched 8 abreast as the delirious New Yorkers jammed the footpaths along the Bowery to see for themselves this all-conquering General George Washington, who had capsized the unbeatable British. Benjamin Talmadge, Washington's key intelligence officer, painted the scene in his memoir. "General Knox, at the head of a select corps of American troops, entered the city, soon after which the commander-in-chief, accompanied by Governor Clinton and their respective suites, made their public entry into the city on horseback, followed by the lieutenant governor and members of the council." But it was Washington who was the cynosure of all eyes. He fitted the physical notion of a peerless leader. A contemporary description stated he was measuring 6 feet 2 inches in his stockings and weighing 175 pounds. His frame is padded with well-developed muscles, indicating great strength. By all accounts, he was one of the best horsemen in the Continental Army and fearless in battle. Many people wanted him as their king, and with a nod of his head, the kingdom would have been his. But Washington would not betray his republican ideals, and soon after resigned from military life. They wanted him as king again, after he served 4 years as president. But Washington again ignored their blandishments, thereby setting in stone the notion of democratic government. Washington would celebrate at Cape's Tavern with Governor George Clinton, and 9 days later would make his famous farewell speech to his troops at nearby Francis Tavern, still standing today. A speech which has been read out every year since by a member of the US Congress on Washington's birthday, February 22. Like Cincinnatus, the farmer who became a general and then returned to his plough after leading the defence of Rome in about 490 BC, Washington was returning to the land in his beloved Virginia after leading the new American army to a great victory. He said in his famous speech, "With a heart full of love and gratitude, I now take leave of you. I most devoutly wish that your later days may be as prosperous and happy as your former ones have been glorious and honourable." If things had turned out differently, he made clear where his last stand would have been. "If defeated everywhere else, I will make my stand for liberty among the Scots-Irish in my native Virginia." But there was no need for that. Thanks in part to the Scots-Irish and Irish Catholics, Washington had carried the day. Indeed, just a few months later, on April 2, 1784, Lord Mountjoy would go on to lament in the British Parliament that "America was lost by Irish immigrants. I am assured from the best authority the major part of the American army was composed of Irish, and that the Irish language was as commonly spoken in the American ranks as English. I am also informed it was their valour that determined the contest." It is not known where Mountjoy was taking his facts from, but modern scholarship has certainly shown the Irish role to have been far greater than was supposed. On November 26, the day after Evacuation Day, Washington would certainly make immediately clear how important the Irish had been to him, especially one man. On his first triumphant day in charge, when he could have met with any number of his greatest generals, dignitaries, or politicians, or attended 100 breakfasts in his honour, Washington mounted his horse Nelson, a handsome chestnut. From where he was staying at No. 1 Broadway, the former residence of Archibald Kennedy, one of the wealthiest men in Manhattan, he rode for a half a mile toward where 219 Pearl Street now stands. There he was going to break his fast with an obscure Irishman from County Derry, once a plain immigrant, living not in a gilded palace or grand hotel, but an unremarkable small townhouse. In Washington's time, the house's address was 23 Queen Street. It was Washington's clear intent on this day, after the greatest of days, to show the world how much he valued the secret role of the man who lived there, one Hercules Mulligan, then aged 43 years. Mulligan's father, Hugh, a deep reader of Greek philosophy and myth, had conferred the strange first name on him, so strange that some believed it was a pseudonym. Washington must have cut a fine figure, a superb horseman, a great general, the father of the new country. But who was this Hercules Mulligan, this haberdasher he wanted so urgently to meet? The fancy set was at a loss to explain it. Yet Washington knew that, as one of his most valuable spies, Mulligan had made a profound difference in the war. Washington certainly felt a debt needed to be repaid. As noted in The Recollections and Private Memoirs of Washington, he breakfasted with Mulligan, to the wonder of the Tories and the perfect horror of the Whigs. Mulligan had saved Washington's life on at least two occasions, historians agree, while putting his own life at risk again and again. Frederick Hitz, former CIA Inspector General, revealed in his book Why Spy? Espionage in an Age of Uncertainty, that former CIA Director William Casey remarked to him in the 1980s that if he had his way, the statue of martyred spy Nathan Hale at the then CIA headquarters in Langley, Virginia, would be replaced by one of Hercules Mulligan. According to Casey, the Irishman was possibly America's best ever espionage agent. Washington also knew that it was Mulligan who had sharpened the steel of a young migrant who had stayed in Mulligan's home for an extended period after he'd landed in America. His name was Alexander Hamilton, and Mulligan is widely credited with turning him from a royalist into a revolutionary. The two spent hours talking when Hamilton was Mulligan's guest, and there is no doubt the Irish rebel had a major impact on the future statesman. The two men became close in life and even in death, as they are buried next to each other in a New York churchyard. Mulligan was what became known as a stay-behind agent when the British took New York. He originally sought to flee, but was unable to escape and continued his job as a master tailor. His wife was the niece of a British admiral. His brother worked for a company that supplied necessary goods to the Redcoats, and Mulligan's loyalist credentials and expert skills as a tailor made him a favourite with the British. Partly because of his strong loyalist links, he did a roaring trade. Newspaper ads at the time featuring Mulligan's store talk of a clothing emporium with superfine clothes of the most fashionable colours, gold and silver spangled buttons, gold epaulettes for gentlemen of the army. For years amidst the dandies, the young posers, and the redcoat generals, Mulligan went doggedly about his task. Years later, he told Benjamin Talmadge, the chief of intelligence for Washington, his stealthy methods of spying. Generals have a way of talking sometimes when they are being fitted for an embroidered waistcoat, so I keep my ears open.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?